There, Henry fell on his knees, sobbing with terror, and putting his gloved hands to his mouth to stifle the sound, because what if it heard? It was Mr. Gray. The cloud was Mr. Gray, and what if it heard? He crawled behind the moss-girdled trunk of a spruce tree, clutched it, then peered around it through the tumbled screen of his sweaty hair. He saw a spark of light in the dark afternoon. It jittered, wavered, and rounded. It became a headlight. Henry began the moan helplessly as the blackness neared. It seemed to hover over his mind like an eclipse, obliterating thought, replacing it with terrible images, milk on his father's chin, panic in Barry Newman's eyes, scrawny bodies and staring eyes behind barbed wire, flayed women and hanged men. For a moment, his understanding of the world seemed to turn inside out like a pocket, and he realized that everything was infected, or could be. Everything. His reasons for contemplating suicide were paltry in the face of this oncoming thing. He pressed his mouth against the tree to keep from screaming, felt his lips tattoo a kiss into the springy moss all the way down to where it was moist and tasted of bark. In that moment, the Arctic cat flashed past, and Henry recognized the figure which straddled it, the person who was generating the red-black cloud which now filled Henry's head like a dry fever. He bit into the moss, screamed against the tree, inhaled fragments of moss without being aware of it, and screamed again. Then he simply knelt there, holding on to the tree and shuddering, as the sound of the Arctic cat began to diminish into the east. He was still there when it had died away to a troublesome whine again. Still there when it faded away entirely. Pete's back there somewhere, he thought. It'll come to Pete and to the woman. Henry stumbled back to the road, unaware that his nose had begun bleeding again, unaware that he was crying. He began moving toward hole in the wall once more, although now the best pace he could manage was a shambling limp. But maybe that was all right, because it was all over back at camp. Whatever the horrible thing was that he had been sensing, it had happened. One of his friends was dead. One was dying. And one, God help him, had become a movie star. Chapter 7. Jonesy and the Beeve. Beaver said it again. No beaverisms now, just that bare Anglo-Saxon syllable you came to when you were up against the wall and had no other way to express the horror you saw. Oh, fuck, man. Fuck. However much pain McCarthy had been in, he had taken time to snap on both of the switches just inside the bathroom door, lighting the fluorescent bars on either side of the medicine chest mirror and the overhead fluorescent ring. These threw a bright, even glare that gave the bathroom the feel of a crime scene photograph. And yet there was a kind of stealthy surrealism, too, because the light wasn't quite steady. There was just enough flicker for you to know the power was coming from a Jenny, and not through a line maintained by Derry and Bangor Hydroelectric. The tile on the floor was baby blue. There were only spots and splatters of blood on it near the door, but as they approached the toilet next to the tub, the splotches ran together and became a red snake. Scarlet capillaries had spread off from this. The tiles were tattooed with the footprints of their boots, which neither Jonesy nor Beaver had taken off. On the blue vinyl shower curtain were four blurred fingerprints, and Jonesy thought he must have reached out and grabbed at the curtain to keep from falling when he turned to sit. Yes, but that wasn't the awful part. The awful part was what Jonesy saw in his mind's eye. McCarthy, scuttling across the baby blue tiles with one hand behind him, clutching himself, trying to hold something in. Oh, fuck, Beavers said again, almost sobbing. I don't want to see this, Jonesy. Man, I can't see this. We've got to. He heard himself speaking as if from a great distance. We can do this, Beav. If we could face up to Richie Grenado and his friends that time, we can face up to this. I don't know, man. I don't know. Jonesy didn't know either. Not really. But he reached out and took Beaver's hand. Beav's fingers closed over his with panicky tightness, and together they went a step deeper into the bathroom. Jonesy tried to avoid the blood, but it was hard. There was blood everywhere. And not all of it was blood.
"Jonesy," Beaver said in a dry, near whisper, "do you see that crud on the shower curtain?"
"Yeah." Growing in the blurred fingerprints were little clumps of reddish-gold mold like mildew. There was more of it on the floor, not in the fat blood snake, but in the narrow angles of the grout.
"What is it?"
"I don't know," Jonesy said. "Same shit he had on his face, I guess. Shut up a minute." Then,
"Mr. McCarthy? Rick?"
McCarthy, sitting there on the toilet, made no response. He had, for some reason, put his orange cap back on. The bill stuck off at a crooked, slightly drunken angle. He was otherwise naked. His chin was down on his breastbone in a parody of deep thought. Or maybe it wasn't a parody, who knew? His eyes were mostly closed. His hands were clasped primly together over his pubic thatch. Blood ran down the side of the toilet in a big, sloppy paint stroke, but there was no blood on McCarthy himself, at least not as far as Jonesy could see. One thing he could see, the skin of McCarthy's stomach hung in two slack dewlaps. The look of it reminded Jonesy of something, and after a moment or two it came to him. It was how Carla's stomach had looked after she had delivered each of their four children. Above McCarthy's hip, where there was a little love handle and some give to the flesh, the skin was only red. Across the belly, however, it had split open in tiny wheals. If McCarthy had been pregnant, it must have been with some sort of a parasite, a tapeworm or a hookworm or something like that. Only there was stuff growing in his spilled blood. And what had he said as he lay there in Jonesy's bed with the blankets pulled up to his chin? "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." This was one knock Jonesy wished he had never answered. In fact, he wished he had shot him. Yes, he saw more clearly now. He was hyped on the clarity that sometimes comes to the completely horrified mind, and in that state wished he had put a bullet in McCarthy before he saw the orange cap and the orange flagman's vest. It couldn't have hurt, and it might have helped. "Stand at the door and knock on my ass," Jonesy muttered.
"Jonesy, is he still alive?"
"I don't know." Jonesy took another step forward and felt Beaver's fingers slide out of his. The Beeve had apparently come as close to McCarthy as he was able.
"Rick?"
Jonesy asked in a hushed voice. A don't wake the baby voice, a viewing the corpse voice.
"Rick, are you?"
There was a loud, dank fart from beneath the man on the toilet, and the room immediately filled with an eye-watering aroma of excrement and airplane glue. Jonesy thought it a wonder that the shower curtain didn't melt. From the bowl there came a splash. Not the plop of a turd dropping, at least Jonesy didn't think so. It sounded more like a fish jumping in a pond.
"Christ almighty, the stink of it!"
Beaver cried. He had the heel of his hand over his mouth and nose, and his words were muffled.
"But if he can fart, he must be alive, huh, Jonesy? He must still be..."
"Hush," Jonesy said in a quiet voice. He was astonished at its steadiness. "Just hush, okay?" And the Beeve hushed. Jonesy leaned in close. He could see everything. The small stipple of blood in McCarthy's right eyebrow, the red growth on his cheek, the blood on the blue plastic curtain, the joke sign, Lamar's Thinking Place, that had hung in here when the toilet was still of the chemical variety and the shower had to be pumped up before it could be used. He saw the little gelid gleam from between McCarthy's eyelids and the cracks in his lips, which looked purple and liverish in this light. He could smell the noxious aroma of the past gas and could almost see that, too, rising in filthy dark yellow streamers like mustard gas.
"McCarthy? Rick? Can you hear me?"
He snapped his fingers in front of those nearly closed eyes. Nothing. He licked a spot on the back of his wrist and held it first in front of McCarthy's nostrils, then in front of his lips. Nothing.
"He's dead, Beaver," he said, drawing back. "Bullshit, he is," Beaver replied. His voice was ragged, absurdly offended, as if McCarthy had violated all the rules of hospitality. "He just dropped a clinker, man, I heard it. I don't think that was...
Beav stepped past him, bumping Jonesy's bad hip against the sink hard enough to hurt.
That's enough, fella, Beaver cried.
He grabbed McCarthy's round, freckled, unmuscled shoulder and shook it.
Snap out of it! Snap!
McCarthy listed slowly tubward, and Jonesy had a moment when he thought Beaver had been right. After all, the guy was still alive. Alive and trying to get up. Then McCarthy fell off the throne and into the tub, pushing the shower curtain ahead of him in a filmy blue billow. The orange hat fell off. There was a bony crack as his skull hit the porcelain. And then Jonesy and Beaver were screaming and clutching each other, the sound of their horror deafening in the little tile-lined room. McCarthy's ass was a lopsided full moon with a gigantic bloody crater in its center, the site of some terrible impact, it seemed. Jonesy saw it for only a second before McCarthy collapsed, face down into the tub, and the curtain floated back into place, hiding him. But in that second, it seemed to Jonesy that the hole was a foot across. Could that be? A foot? Surely not. In the toilet bowl, something splashed again, hard enough to splatter droplets of bloody water up onto the ring, which was also blue. Beaver started to lean forward to look in, and Jonesy slammed the lid down on the ring without even thinking about it.
No,
he said.
No?
No. Beaver tried to get a toothpick out of the front pocket of his overalls, came up with half a dozen, and dropped them on the floor. They rolled across the bloody blue tiles like jackstraws. The Beav looked at them, then looked up at Jonesy. There were tears standing in his eyes.
Like Duddits, man, he said.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Don't you remember? He was almost naked, too. Fuckers snatched off his shirt and his pants, didn't leave him nothing but his underpants. But we saved him.
Beaver nodded vigorously as if Jonesy, or some deep and doubtful part of himself, had scoffed at this idea. Jonesy scoffed at nothing, although McCarthy didn't remind him in the slightest of Dubbitt's. He kept seeing McCarthy going over sideways into the tub, his orange hat falling off, the fatty deposits on his chest, the tits of easy living, Henry called them whenever he saw a pair underneath some guy's polo shirt, wobbling. And then his ass, turning up to the light, that harsh fluorescent light that kept no secrets but blabbed everything in a droning monotone. That perfect white man's ass, hairless, just starting to turn flabby and settle down on the backs of the thighs. He had seen a thousand like it in the various locker rooms where he had dressed and showered, was developing one himself, or had been until a guy had run him over, changing the physical configuration of his backside, perhaps forever. Only he had never seen one like McCarthy's was now. One that looked like something inside had fired a flare or a shotgun shell in order to what? There was another hollow splash from the toilet. The lid bumped up. It was as good an answer as any. In order to get out, of course. In order to get out.
Sit on that, Jonesy told Beaver.
Huh? Sit on it!
Jonesy almost shouted it this time, and Beaver sat down on the closed lid in a hurry, looking startled. In the no-secrets, flat-toned light of the fluorescence, Beaver's skin looked as white as freshly turned clay, and every fleck of black stubble was a mole. His lips were purple. Above his head was the old joke sign, Lamar's Thinking Place. Beaver's blue eyes were wide and terrified.
I'm sitting, Jonesy. See?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Beaver, but you just sit there, all right? Whatever he had inside him, it's trapped. Got nowhere to go but the septic tank. I'll be back. Where are you going? Because I don't want you to leave me sitting in the shithouse next to a dead man, Jonesy. If we both run...
We're not running, Jonesy said grimly. This is our place, and we're not running. Which sounded noble, but left out at least one aspect of the situation. He was mostly just afraid. The thing that was now in the toilet might be able to run faster than they could. Or squiggle faster. Or something. Clips from 100 horror films, Parasite, Alien, They Came From Within, ran through his mind at super speed. Carla wouldn't go to the movies with him when one of those was playing, and she made him go downstairs and use the TV in his study when he brought them home on tape. But one of those movies, Something he'd seen in one of them just might save their lives. Jonesy glanced at the reddish-gold mildewy stuff growing on McCarthy's bloody handprint. Save their lives from the thing in the toilet, anyway. The mildewy stuff, who in God's name knew? The thing in the bowl leaped again, thudding the underside of the lid, but Beaver had no trouble holding the lid down. That was good. Maybe whatever it was would drown in there, although Jonesy didn't see how they could count on that. It had been living inside of McCarthy, hadn't it? It had been living inside old Mr. Behold I Stand at the Door and Knock for quite some time, maybe the whole 4 days he'd been lost in the woods. It had slowed the growth of McCarthy's beard, it seemed, and caused a few of his teeth to fall out. It had also caused McCarthy to pass gas that probably couldn't have gone ignored even in the politest of polite society. Farts like poison gas, to be perfectly blunt about it. But the thing itself had apparently been fine. Lively. Growing. Jonesy had a sudden, vivid image of a wriggling, white tapeworm emerging from a pile of raw meat. His gorge rose with a liquid chugging sound. Jonesy? Beaver started to get up. He looked more alarmed than ever. Beaver, sit back down! Beaver did, just in time. The thing in the toilet leaped and hit the underside of the lid with a hard, hollow rap. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. Remember that Lethal Weapon movie where Mel Gibson's partner didn't dare to get off the crapper? Beaver said. He smiled, but his voice was dry, and his eyes were terrified. This is like that, isn't it? No, Jonesy said, because nothing's going to blow up. Besides, I'm not Mel Gibson, and you're too fucking white to be Danny Glover. Listen, Beav, I'm going out to the shed. No way, don't leave me here all by myself. Shut up and listen. There's friction tape out there, isn't there? Yeah, hanging on a nail, at least I think. Hanging on a nail, that's right, near the paint cans, I think. A big fat roll of it, I'm going to get that, and then come back and tape the lid down. Then it leaped again, furiously, as if it could hear and understand. Well, how do we know it can't, Jonesy thought. When it hit the bottom of the lid with a hard, vicious thud, the beeve winced. Then we're getting out of here, Jonesy finished. On the cat? Jonesy nodded, although he had, in fact, forgotten all about the snowmobile. Yeah, on the cat, and we'll hook up with Henry and Pete. The beeve was shaking his head. Quarantine! That's what the guy in the helicopter said. That must be why they haven't come back yet, don't you think? They must have got held out by the thud. Beaver winced. So did Jonesy. By the quarantine. That could be, Jonesy said, but listen, Beave, I'd rather be quarantined with Pete and Henry than here. Wouldn't you? Let's just flush it down, Beaver said. How about that? Jonesy shook his head. Why not? Because I saw the hole it made getting out, Jonesy said, and so did you. I don't know what it is, but we're not going to get rid of it by just pushing a handle. It's too big. Fuck. Beaver slammed the heel of his hand against his forehead. Jonesy nodded. All right, Jonesy, go get the tape. In the doorway, Jonesy paused and looked back. And Beaver? Beaver raised his eyebrows. Sit tight, buddy. Beaver started to giggle. So did Jonesy. They looked at each other, Jonesy in the doorway and the beeve sitting on the closed toilet seat, snorting laughter. Then Jonesy hurried across the big central room, still giggling, sit tight, the more he thought about it, the funnier it seemed, toward the kitchen door. He felt hot and feverish, both horrified and hilarious. Sit tight. Jesus Christ, bananas. Beeve could hear Jonesy giggling all the way across the room, still giggling when he went out the door. In spite of everything, Beeve was glad to hear that sound. It had already been a bad year for Jonesy, getting run over the way he had. For a while there at first, they'd all thought he was going to step out. And that was awful. Poor old Jonesy wasn't yet 38. Bad year for Pete, who'd been drinking too much. A bad year for Henry, who sometimes got a spooky absence about him that Beeve didn't understand and didn't like. And now, he guessed you could say, it had been a bad year for Beaver Clarendon as well. Of course, this was only one day in 365, but you just didn't get up in the morning thinking that by afternoon there'd be a dead guy lying naked in the tub and you'd be sitting on a closed toilet seat in order to keep something you hadn't even seen from...
Nope, Beaver said.
Not going there, okay? Just not going there.
And he didn't have to. Jonesy would be back with the friction tape in a minute or two, 3 minutes tops. The question was, where did he want to go until Jonesy returned? Where could he go and feel good?
Duddits. That was where.
Thinking about Duddits always made him feel good. And Roberta, thinking about her was good too, undoubtedly. Beav smiled, remembering the little woman in the yellow dress who'd been standing at the end of her walk on Maple Lane that day. The smile widened as he remembered how she caught sight of them. She had called her boy that same thing. She had called him,
Duddits, she cries.
A little graying wren of a woman in a flowered print dress then runs up the sidewalk toward them. Duddits has been walking contentedly with his new friends, chattering away 6 licks to the minute, holding his Scooby-Doo lunchbox in his left hand and Jonesy's hand in his right, swinging it cheerfully back and forth. His gabble seems to consist almost entirely of open vowel sounds. The thing which amazes Beaver the most about it is how much of it he understands. Now, catching sight of the graying birdie woman, Duddits lets go of Jonesy's hand and runs toward her, both of them running, and it reminds Beaver of some musical about a bunch of singers, the Von Cripps or Von Kraps or something like that.
Mommy! Mommy!
Duddits shouts exuberantly. Mommy! Mommy!
Where have you been? Where have you been, you bad boy, you bad old Duddits?
They come together, and Duddits is so much bigger, 2 or 3 inches taller, too, that Beaver winces, expecting the birdie woman to be flattened the way Coyote is always getting flattened in the Roadrunner cartoons. Instead, she picks him up and swings him around, his sneakered feet flying out behind him, his mouth stretched halfway up to his ears in an expression of joyful ecstasy.
I was just about to go in and call the police, you bad old late thing, you bad old late...
She sees Beaver and his friends and sets her son down on his feet. Her smile of relief is gone. She is solemn as she steps toward them over some little girl's hopscotch grid. Crude as it is, Beav thinks, even that will always be beyond Duddits. The tears still gleam on her cheeks, gleaming in the glow of the sun that has finally broken through.
Uh-oh, Pete says. We're going to catch it.
Be cool, Henry says, speaking low and fast. Let her rant, and then I'll explain. But they have misjudged Roberta Cavell, have judged her by the standard of so many adults who seem to view boys their age as guilty until proven innocent. Roberta Cavell isn't that way, and neither is her husband, Alfie. The Cavells are different. Duddits has made them different.
Boys, she says again, was he wandering? Was he lost? I've been so afraid to let him walk, but he wants so much to be a real boy.
She gives Beaver's fingers a strong squeeze with one hand and Pete's with the other. Then she drops them, takes Jonesy's and Henry's hands, and gives them the same treatment.
Ma'am, Henry begins.
Mrs. Cavell looks at Henry with fixed concentration, as if she is trying to read his mind.
Not just lost, she says. Not just wandering.
Ma'am?
Henry tries again, and then gives up any thought of dissembling. It is Duddits's green gaze looking at him from her face, only intelligent and aware, keen and questioning.
No, ma'am, Henry sighs. Not just wandering.
Because he usually comes right home. He says he can't get lost because he sees the line.
How many were there?
Oh, a few, Jonesy says, then shoots a swift look at Henry.
Beside them, Duddits has found a last few gone to see dandelions on the neighbor's lawn and is down on his belly, blowing the fluff off them and watching it float away on the breeze.
A few boys were teasing him, ma'am.
Big boys, Pete says.
Again, her eyes search them, from Jonesy to Pete, from Pete to Beaver, and then back to Henry again.
Come up to the house with us, she says. I want to hear all about it. Duddits has a big glass of Xarex every afternoon. It's his special drink. But I'll bet you guys would rather have iced tea, wouldn't you?
The three of them look at Henry, who considers, and then nods.
Yes, ma'am. Iced tea would be great.
So She leads them back to the house where they'll spend so much of their time in the following years, the house at 19 Maple Lane. Only it is really Duddits who leads the way, prancing, skipping, sometimes lifting his yellow Scooby-Doo lunchbox over his head, but always, Beaver notices, keeping it almost exactly the same place on the sidewalk, about a foot from the grass margin between the walk and the street. Years later, after the thing with the Rinkenhauer girl, he will consider what Mrs. Cavell said. They all will.
He sees the line.
Jonesy! Beaver called.
No answer. Christ, it seemed like Jonesy had been gone a long time. Probably hadn't been, but there was no way Beaver could tell. He'd forgotten to put on his watch that morning. Stupid, but then he'd always been stupid. He ought to be used to it by now. Next to Jonesy and Henry, both he and Pete had been stupid. Not that Jonesy or Henry had ever treated them that way. That was one of the great things about them.
Jonesy!
Still nothing. Probably he was having trouble finding the tape, that was all. There was a vile little voice far back in Beaver's head telling him that the tape had nothing to do with it, that Jonesy had just gone Powder River, leaving him there to sit on the toilet like Danny Glover in that movie. But he wouldn't listen to that voice because Jonesy would never do anything like that. They were friends to the end. Always had been. That's right, the vile voice agreed. You were friends. And this is the end.
Jonesy! You there, man?
Still nothing. Maybe the tape had fallen off the nail it had been hung on. Nothing from beneath him, either. And hey, it really wasn't possible that McCarthy had shit some kind of monster into the John, was it? That he'd given birth to, gasp, the beast in the bowl? It sounded like a horror movie spoof on Saturday Night Live. And even if that had happened, the beast in the bowl had probably drowned by now. Drowned or gone deep. A line from a story suddenly occurred to him, one they'd read to Duddits, taking turns, and it was good there were four of them, because when Duddits liked something, he never got tired of it.
E-dool!
Duddits would shout, running to one of them with the book held high over his head the way he carried his lunchbox home that first day.
E-dool! E-dool!
Which in this case meant, read pool, read pool. The book was McGilligut's Pool by Dr. Seuss, the first memorable couplet of which went, Young man, argued the farmer, you're sort of a fool. You'll never catch fish in McGilligut's pool. But there had been fish, at least in the imagination of the little boy in the story. Plenty of fish. Big fish. No splashes from beneath him, though. No bumps on the underside of the lid, either. Not for a while now. He could maybe risk one quick look. Just raise the lid a little and slam it back down, if anything. But sit tight, buddy, was the last thing Jonesy had said to him, and that was what he'd better do. Jonesy's most likely a mile down the road by now, the vile voice estimated. A mile down the road, and still picking up speed.
No, he ain't, Beaver said. Not Jonesy.
He shifted a little bit on the closed seat, waiting for the thing to jump, but it didn't. It might be 60 yards away by now and swimming with the turds in the septic tank. Jonesy had said it was too big to go down, but since neither of them had actually seen it, there was no way to tell for sure, was there? But in either case, Monsieur Beaver Clarendon was going to sit right here, because he'd said he would. Because time always seemed slower when you were worried or scared, and because he trusted Jonesy. Jonesy and Henry had never hurt him or made fun, not of him and not of Pete. And none of them had ever hurt Duddits or made fun of him either. Beeves snorted laughter. Duddits with his Scooby-Doo lunchbox. Duddits on his belly blowing the fluff off dandelions. Duddits running around in his backyard, happy as a bird in a tree, yeah. And people who called kids like him special didn't know the half of it. He had been special, all right. Their present from a fucked-up world that usually didn't give you jack shit. Duddits had been their own special thing, and they had loved him. They sit in the sunny kitchen nook, the clouds have gone away as if by magic, drinking iced tea and watching Duddits, who drank his Xarex, awful-looking orange stuff, in three or four huge, splattering gulps, and then ran out back to play. Henry does most of the talking, telling Mrs. Cavell that the boys were just kind of pushing him around. He says that they got a little bit rough and ripped his shirt, which scared Duddits and made him cry. There is no mention of how Richie Grenadeau and his friends took off his pants, no mention of the nasty after-school snack they wanted Duddits to eat. And when Mrs. Cavell asks them if they know who these big boys were, Henry hesitates briefly and then says, no, just some big boys from the high school. He didn't know any of them, not by name. She looks at Beaver, Jonesy, and Pete. They all shake their heads. It may be wrong, dangerous to Duddits in the long run as well, but they can't step that far outside the rules which govern their lives. Already, Beaver cannot understand where they found the sack to intervene in the first place, and later, the others will say the same. They marvel at their courage. They also marvel that they aren't in the fucking hospital. She looks at them sadly for a moment, and Beaver realizes she knows a lot of what they aren't telling, probably enough to keep her awake that night. Then she smiles. Right at Beaver, she smiles, and it makes him tingle all the way down to his toes.
What a lot of zippers you have on your jacket, she says.
Beaver smiles.
Yes, ma'am. It's my Fonzie jacket. It was my brother's first. These guys make fun of it, but I like it just the same.
Happy days, she said. We like it, too. Duddits likes it. Perhaps you'd like to come over some night and watch it with us, with him.
Her smile grows wistful, as if she knows nothing like that will ever happen.
Yeah, that'd be okay, Beaver says. Actually, it would, Pete agrees.
They sit for a little, without talking, just watching him play in the backyard. There's a swing set with two swings. Duddits runs behind them, pushing them, making the swings go by themselves. Sometimes he stops, crosses his arms over his chest, turns the clockless dial of his face up to the sky, and laughs.
Seems all right now, Jonesy says, and drinks the last of his tea. Guess he's forgotten all about it.
Mrs. Cavell has started to get up. Now she sits back down, giving him an almost startled look.
Oh, no, not at all, she says. He remembers. Not like you and I, perhaps, but he remembers things. He'll probably have nightmares tonight, and when we go into his room, his father and me, he won't be able to explain. That's the worst for him. He can't tell what it is he sees and thinks and feels. He doesn't have the vocabulary.
She sighs.
In any case, those boys won't forget about him. What if they're laying for him now? What if they're laying for you?
We can take care of ourselves, Jonesy says. But although his voice is stout enough, his eyes are uneasy.
Maybe, she says. But what about Duddits?
I can walk into school. I used to, and I suppose I'll have to again, for a while at least anyway. But he loves to walk home on his own so much. It makes him feel like a big boy, Pete says.
She reaches across the table and touches Pete's hand, making him blush.
That's right. It makes him feel like a big boy.
You know, Henry says, we could walk him. We all go together to the junior high, and it would be easy enough to come down here from Kansas Street.
Roberta Cavell only sits there without saying anything. A little birdy woman in a print dress, looking at Henry attentively, like someone waiting for the punchline of a joke.
Will that be okay, Mrs. Cavell? Beaver asks her. Because we could do it easy. Well, maybe you don't want us to.
Something complicated happens to Mrs. Cavell's face. There are all those little twitches, mostly under the skin. One eye almost winks, and then the other one does wink. She takes a handkerchief from her pocket and blows her nose. Beaver thinks, she's trying not to laugh at us. When he tells Henry that as they are walking home, Jonesy and Pete already dropped off, Henry will look at him with utter astonishment.
Cry is what she was trying not to do, he will say.
And then, affectionately, after a pause, dope.
You would do that? She asks.
And when Henry nods for all of them, she changes the question slightly.
Why would you do that?
Henry looks around as if to say, someone else take this one, will you? Pete says,
we like 'em, ma'am.
Jonesy is nodding.
I like the way he carries his lunchbox over his head. Yeah, that's bitchin', Pete says.
Henry kicks him under the table. Pete replays what he just said, you can see him doing it, and begins blushing furiously.
Mrs. Cavell appears not to notice. She is looking at Henry with fixed intensity.
He has to go by 7:45, she says.
We're always near here by then, Henry replies. Aren't we, you guys?
And although 7:45 is in fact a little early for them, they all nod and say, yeah, yeah, right, sure, yeah.
You would do that? She asks again.
And this time Beaver has no trouble reading her tone. She is incredulous, the word that means you can't fucking believe it.
Sure, Henry says, unless you think Duddits wouldn't
want us to, Jonesy finishes.
Are you crazy? She asks.
Beaver thinks she is speaking to herself, trying to convince herself that these boys are really in her kitchen, that all of this is in fact happening.
Walking to school with the big boys? Boys who go to what Duddits calls real school? He'd think he was in heaven.
Okay, Henry says. We'll come by 7:45, walk him to school, and we'll walk home with him, too.
He gets out at...
Ah, we know what time the retired academy gets out, Beaver says cheerfully,
and realizes a second before he sees the others' stricken faces that he's said something a lot worse than bitchin'. He claps his hands over his mouth. Above them, his eyes are huge. Jonesy kicks his shin so hard under the table that Beav almost tumbles over backward.
Don't mind him, ma'am, Henry says.
He's talking rapidly, which he only does when he's embarrassed.
He just... I don't mind, she says. I know what people call it. Sometimes Alfie and I call it that ourselves.
This topic, incredibly, hardly seems to interest her.
Why?
She says again. And although it's Henry she's looking at, it's Beaver who answers in spite of his blazing cheeks.
Because he's cool, he says.
The others nod.
They will walk Duddits to school and back for the next 5 years or so, unless he is sick or they are at hole in the wall. By the end of it, Duddits is no longer going to Mary M. Snow, a.k.a. the Retard Academy, but to Dairy Vocational, where he learns to bake cookies,
baitin' tooties,
in Duddits's, replace car batteries, make change, and tie his own tie. The knot is always perfect, although it sometimes appears about halfway down his shirt. By then, the Josie Rinkenhauer thing has come and gone. A little 9 days wonder, forgotten by everyone except Josie's parents, who will never forget. In those years when they walk with him to and from his school, Duddits will sprout up until he's the tallest of all of them, a gangly teenager with a strangely beautiful child's face. By then, they will have taught him how to play Parcheesi and a simplified version of Monopoly. By then, they will have invented the Duddits game and played it incessantly, sometimes laughing so hard that Alfie Cavell, he was the tall one of the pair, but he also had a birdie look about him, would come to the head of the stairs in the kitchen, the ones that led to the rec room, and yell down at them, wanting to know what was going on, what was so funny. And maybe they would try to explain that Duddits had pegged Henry 14 on a two-hand, or that Duddits had pegged Pete 15 backward. But Alfie never seemed to get it. He'd stand there at the head of the stairs with a section of the newspaper in his hand, smiling perplexedly, and at last he'd always say the same thing, "Keep it down to a dull roar, boys," and close the door, leaving them to their own devices. And of all those devices, the Duddits game was the best, totally bitchin', as Pete would have said. There were times when Beaver had thought he might actually laugh until he exploded, and Duddits, sitting there all the time on the rug beside the big old Parkman cribbage board, feet folded under him and grinning like Buddha. What a fuckery! All of that ahead of them. But now, just this kitchen, and the surprising sun, and Duddits outside pushing the swings. Duddits, who had done them such a favor by coming into their lives. Duddits, who is, they know it from the first, not like anyone else they know.
I don't see how they could have done it, Pete says suddenly. The way he was crying. I don't see how they could have gone on teasing him.
Roberta Cavell looks at him sadly.
Older boys don't hear him the same way, she says. I hope you never understand.
Jonesy! Beaver shouted. Hey, Jonesy!
This time there's a response, faint but unmistakable. The snowmobile shed was a kind of ground-level attic, and one of the things out there was an old-fashioned bulb horn, the kind a bicycle delivery man back in the 20s or 30s might have mounted on the handlebars of his bike. Now Beaver heard it.
Hooga! Hawooga!
A noise that surely would have made Duddits laugh until he cried. A sucker for big, juicy noises that had been old Dud's. The filmy blue shower curtain rustled, and the Beeve's arms broke out in lush bundles of goose flesh. For a moment, he almost leapt up, thinking that it was McCarthy, then realized he'd brushed the curtain with his own elbow. It was close quarters in here, close quarters no doubt, and settled back. Still nothing from beneath him, though. That thing, whatever it was either dead or gone, for certain. Well, almost for certain. Beeve reached behind him, fingered the flush lever for a moment, then let his hand fall away. Sit tight, Jonesy had said, and Beaver would. But why the fuck didn't Jonesy come back? If he couldn't find the tape, why didn't he just come back without it? It had to have been at least 10 minutes now, didn't it? And felt like a fucking hour. Meantime, here he sat on the john with a dead man in the tub beside him, one who looked as if his ass had been blown open by dynamite. Man, talk about having to take a shit. Beep the horn again, at least, Beaver muttered. Honk that geezly thing, let me know you're still there. But Jonesy didn't. Jonesy couldn't find the tape. He'd looked everywhere and couldn't find it anywhere. He knew it had to be here, but it wasn't hanging from any of the nails, and it wasn't on the tool-littered work table. It wasn't behind the paint cans or on the hook beneath the old painting masks that hung there by their yellowing elastics. He looked under the table, looked in the boxes stacked against the far wall, then in the compartment under the Arctic Cat's passenger seat. There was a spare headlight in there, still in its carton, and half a pack of ancient Lucky Strikes, but no goddamn tape. He could feel the minutes ticking away. Once he was pretty sure he heard the Beeve calling for him, but he didn't want to go back without the tape, so he blew the old horn that was lying on the floor, pumping its cracked black rubber horn and making an ooga-ooga sound that Duddits no doubt would have loved. The more he looked for the tape and didn't find it, the more imperative it seemed. There was a ball of twine, but how would you tie down a toilet seat with twine, for Christ's sake? And there was scotch tape in one of the kitchen drawers, he was almost sure of it, but the thing in the toilet had sounded pretty strong, like a good-sized fish or something. Scotch tape just wasn't good enough. Jonesy stood beside the Arctic Cat, looking around with wide eyes, running his hands through his hair. He hadn't put his gloves back on, and he'd been out here long enough to numb his fingers, breathing out big white puffs of vapor. Where the fuck? He asked aloud and slammed his fist down on the table. A stack of little boxes filled with nails and screws fell over when he did, and there was the friction tape behind them, a big, fat roll of it. He must have looked right past it a dozen times. He grabbed it, stuffed it in his coat pocket, he had remembered to put that on at least, although he hadn't bothered to zip it up, and turned to go, and that was when Beaver began to scream. His calls had been barely there, but Jonesy had no trouble at all hearing the screams. They were big, lusty, filled with pain. Jonesy sprinted for the door. Beaver's mom had always said the toothpicks would kill him, but she had never imagined anything like this. Sitting there on the closed toilet seat, Beaver felt in the bib pocket of his overalls for a pick to chew on, but there weren't any. They were scattered all over the floor. Two or three had landed clear of the blood, but he'd have to rise up off the toilet seat a little to get them. Rise up and lean forward. Beaver debated. Sit tight, Jonesy had said, but surely the thing in the toilet was gone. Dive, 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 as they said in the submarine war movies. But even if it wasn't, he'd only be lifting his ass for a second or two.
If the thing jumped, Beaver could bring his weight right back down again, maybe break its scaly little neck for it, always assuming it had one.